This is Audible.
Simon & Schuster Audio presents The Dead Zone by Stephen King. Read by James Franco.
This is for you, Owen. I love you, old bear. Prologue. 1. By the time he graduated from college, John Smith had forgotten all about the bad fall he took on the ice that January day in 1953. In fact, it would have been hard put to remember it by the time he graduated from grammar school, and his mother and father never knew about it at all. They were skating on a cleared patch of runaround pond in Durham. The bigger boys were playing hockey with old tape sticks and using a couple of potato baskets for goals. The little kids were just farting around the way little kids have done since time immemorial, their ankles bowing comically in and out, their breath puffing in the frosty 20-degree air. At one corner of the cleared ice, two rubber tires burned sootily, and a few parents sat nearby, watching their children. The age of the snowmobile was still distant, and winter fun still consisted of exercising your body rather than a gasoline engine. Johnny had walked down from his house, just over the Pownell line, with his skates hung over his shoulder. At 6, he was a pretty fair skater, not good enough to join in the big kids' hockey games yet, but able to skate rings around most of the other first graders, who were always pinwheeling their arms for balance or sprawling on their butts. Now he skated slowly around the outer edge of the clear patch, wishing he could go backward like Timmy Benedict's, listening to the ice thud and crackle mysteriously under the snow cover farther out, also listening to the shouts of the hockey players, the rumble of a pulp truck crossing the bridge on its way to U.S. Gypsum in Lisbon Falls, the murmur of conversation from the adults. He was very glad to be alive on that cold, fair winter day. Nothing was wrong with him. Nothing troubled his mind. He wanted nothing, except to be able to skate backward like Timmy Benedict's. He skated past the fire and saw that two or three of the grown-ups were passing around a bottle of booze. "Give me some of that," he shouted to Chuck Spear, who was bundled up in a big lumberjack shirt and green flannel snow pants. Chuck grinned at him. "Get out of here, kid. I hear your mother calling you." Grinning, 6-year-old Johnny Smith skated on, and on the roadside of the skating area, he saw Timmy Benedict himself coming down the slope, with his father behind him. "Timmy," he shouted, "watch this." He turned around and began to skate clumsily backward. Without realizing it, he was skating into the area of the hockey game. "Hey, kid," someone shouted, "get out of the way." Johnny didn't hear him. He was doing it. He was skating backward. He had caught the rhythm all at once. It was in a kind of sway of the legs. He looked down, fascinated, to see what his legs were doing. The big kid's hockey puck, old and scarred and gouged around the edges, buzzed past him, unseen. One of the big kids, not a very good skater, was chasing it with what was almost a blind, headlong plunge. Chuck Spear saw it coming. He rose to his feet and shouted, "Johnny, watch out!" John raised his head, and the next moment, the clumsy skater, all 160 pounds of him, crashed into little John Smith at full speed. Johnny went flying, arms out. A bare moment later, his head connected with the ice, and he blacked out. Blacked out. Black ice. Blacked out. Black ice. Black. Black. They told him he had blacked out. All he was really sure of was that strange, repeating thought, and suddenly, looking up at a circle of faces, scared hockey players, worried adults, curious little kids. Timmy Benedict smirking. Chuck Spear was holding him. Black ice. Black. "What?" Chuck asked. "Johnny, you okay? You took a hell of a knock." "Black," Johnny said gutturally. "Black ice. Don't jump it no more, Chuck." Chuck looked around a little scared, then back at Johnny. He touched a large knot that was rising on the boy's forehead. "I'm sorry," the clumsy hockey player said. "I never even saw him. Little kids are supposed to stay away from the hockey. It's the rules." He looked around uncertainly for support. "Johnny," Chuck said. He didn't like the look of Johnny's eyes. They were dark and far away, distant and cold. "Are you okay?" "Don't jump it no more," Johnny said, unaware of what he was saying, thinking only of ice, black ice. The explosion. The acid. "Think we ought to take him to the doctor?" Chuck asked Bill Gendron. "You don't know what he's saying." "Give him a minute," Bill advised. They gave him a minute, and Johnny's head did clear. "I'm okay," he muttered. "Let me up." Timmy Benedict was still smirking, damn him. Johnny decided he would show Timmy a thing or two. He would be skating rings around Timmy by the end of the week, backward and forward. "You come over here and sit down by the fire for a while," Chuck said. "You took a hell of a knock." Johnny let them help him over to the fire. The smell of melting rubber was strong and pungent, making him feel a little sick to his stomach. He had a headache. He felt a lump over his eye curiously. It felt as though it stuck out a mile. "Can you remember who you are and everything?" Bill asked.
"Sure. Sure I can. I'm okay."
"Who's your dad and mom?"
"Herb and Vera. Herb and Vera Smith."
Bill and Chuck looked at each other and shrugged. "I think he's okay," Chuck said. And then for the third time, "But he sure took a hell of a knock, didn't he? Wow." "Kids," Bill said, looking fondly out at his 8-year-old twin girls, skating hand in hand and then back at Johnny. "It probably would have killed a grown-up." "Not a Pollock," Chuck replied, and they both burst out laughing. The bottle of Bushmills began making its rounds again. 10 minutes later, Johnny was back out on the ice, his headache already fading, the knotted bruise standing out on his forehead like a weird brand. By the time he went home for lunch, he had forgotten all about the fall and blacking out, and the joy of having discovered how to skate backward.
"God's mercy," Vera Smith said when she saw him. "How did you get that?"
"Fell down," he said, and began to slurp up Campbell's tomato soup.
"Are you all right, John?" she asked, touching it gently. "Sure, Mom."
He was, too, except for the occasional bad dreams that came over the course of the next month or so. The bad dreams and a tendency to sometimes get very dozy at times of the day when he had never been dozy before. And that stopped happening at about the same time the bad dreams stopped happening. He was all right. In mid-February, Chuck Spear got up one morning and found that the battery of his old 48 DeSoto was dead. He tried to jump it from his farm truck. As he attached the second clamp to the DeSoto's battery, it exploded in his face, showering with fragments and corrosive battery acid. He lost an eye. Vera said it was God's own mercy he hadn't lost them both. Johnny thought it was a terrible tragedy and went with his father to visit Chuck in the Lewiston General Hospital a week after the accident. The sight of Big Chuck lying in that hospital bed, looking oddly wasted and small, had shaken Johnny badly. And that night, he had dreamed it was him lying there. From time to time in the years afterward, Johnny had hunches. He would know what the next record on the radio was going to be before the DJ played it, that sort of thing. But he never connected these with his accident on the ice. By then, he had forgotten it. And the hunches were never that startling, or even very frequent. It was not until the night of the county fair and the mask that anything very startling happened, before the second accident. Later, he thought of that often. The thing with the Wheel of Fortune had happened before the second accident, like a warning from his own childhood.
2. The traveling salesman crisscrossed Nebraska and Iowa tirelessly under the burning sun in that summer of 1955. He sat behind the wheel of a 53 Mercury sedan that already had better than 70,000 miles on it. The Merc was developing a marked wheeze in the valves. He was a big man who still had the look of a corn-fed Midwestern boy on him. In that summer of 1955, only 4 months after his Omaha house painting business had gone broke, Greg Stilson was only 22 years old. The trunk and the back seat of the Mercury were filled with cartons, and the cartons were filled with books. Most of them were Bibles.
They came in all shapes and sizes. There was your basic item, the American Truthway Bible, illustrated with 16 color plates, bound with airplane glue, for $1.69, and sure to hold together for at least 10 months. Then for the poorer pocketbook, there was the American Truthway New Testament for 65 cents, with no color plates, but with the words of Our Lord Jesus printed in red. And for the big spender, there was the American Truthway Deluxe Word of God for $19.95, bound in imitation white leather, the owner's name to be stenciled in gold leaf on the front cover, 24 color plates, and a section in the middle to note down births, marriages, and burials. And the deluxe Word of God might remain in one piece for as long as 2 years. There was also a carton of paperbacks entitled America the Truthway, the Communist Jewish Conspiracy Against Our United States. Greg did better with this paperback printed on cheap pulp stock than with all the Bibles put together. It told all about how the Rothschilds and the Roosevelts and the Greenblatts were taking over the U.S. economy and the U.S. government. There were graphs showing how the Jews related directly to the communist, Marxist, Leninist, Trotskyite axis, and from there to the Antichrist itself. The days of McCarthyism were not long over in Washington. In the Midwest, Joe McCarthy's star had not yet set, and Margaret Chase Smith of Maine was known as that bitch for her famous declaration of conscience. In addition to the stuff about communism, Greg Stilson's rural farm constituency seemed to have a morbid interest in the idea that the Jews were running the world. Now Greg turned into the dusty driveway of a farmhouse some 20 miles west of Ames, Iowa. It had a deserted, shut-up look to it, the shades down and the barn doors closed, but you could never tell until you tried. That motto had served Greg Stilson well in the 2 years or so since he and his mother had moved up to Omaha from Oklahoma. The house painting business had been no great shakes, but he had needed to get the taste of Jesus out of his mouth for a little while. You should pardon the small blasphemy. But now he had come back home. Not on the pulpit or revival side this time, though. And it was something of a relief to be out of the miracle business at last. He opened the car door, and as he stepped out into the dust of the driveway, a big, mean farm dog advanced out of the barn, its ears laid back. It volleyed barks.
"Hello, Pooch,"
Greg said in his low, pleasant, but caring voice. At 22, it was already the voice of a trained spellbinder. The pooch didn't respond to the friendliness in his voice. It kept coming, big and mean, intent on an early lunch of traveling salesmen. Greg sat back down in the car, closed the door, and honked the horn twice. Sweat rolled down his face and turned his white linen suit darker gray in circular patches under his arms and in a branching tree shape up his back. He honked again, but there was no response. The clodhoppers had loaded themselves into their International Harvester or their Studebaker and gone into town. Greg smiled. Instead of shifting into reverse and backing out of the driveway, he reached behind him and produced a flit gun. Only this one was loaded with ammonia instead of flit. Pulling back the plunger, Greg stepped out of the car again, smiling easily. The dog, which had settled down on its haunches, immediately got up again and began to advance on him, growling. Greg kept smiling.
"That's right, Poochie," he said in that pleasant, caring voice. "You just come on. Come on and get it."
He hated these ugly farm dogs that ran their half acre of dooryard like arrogant little Caesars. They told you something about their masters as well.
"Fucking bunch of clodhoppers,"
he said under his breath. He was still smiling.
"Come on, doggy."
The dog came. It tensed its haunches down to spring at him. In the barn, a cow mooed, and the wind rustled tenderly through the corn. As it leaped, Greg's smile turned to a hard and bitter grimace. He depressed the flit plunger and sprayed a stinging cloud of ammonia droplets directly into the dog's eyes and nose. Its angry barking turned immediately to short, agonized yips, and then, as the bite of ammonia really settled in, to howls of pain. It turned tail at once, a watchdog no longer, but only a vanquished cur. Greg Stilson's face had darkened. His eyes had drawn down to ugly slits. He stepped forward rapidly and administered a whistling kick to the dog's haunches with one of his Stride King air-tip shoes. The dog gave a high wailing sound, and driven by its pain and fear, it sealed its own doom by turning around to give battle to the author of its misery, rather than running for the barn. With a snarl, it struck out blindly, snagging the right cuff of Greg's white linen pants, and tore it.
"You son of a bitch!"
he cried out in startled anger, and kicked the dog again, this time hard enough to send it rolling in the dust. He advanced on the dog once more, kicking it again, still yelling. Now the dog, eyes watering, nose in fiery agony, one rib broken and another badly sprung, realized its danger from this madman, but it was too late. Greg Stilson chased it across the dusty farmyard, panting and shouting, sweat rolling down his cheeks, and kicked the dog until it was screaming and barely able to drag itself along through the dust. It was bleeding in half a dozen places. It was dying.
"Shouldn't have bit me," Greg whispered. "You hear? You hear me? You shouldn't have bit me, you dipshit dog. No one gets in my way. You hear? No one."
He delivered another kick with one blood-spattered air tip, but the dog could do no more than make a low, choking sound. Not much satisfaction in that. Greg's head ached. It was the sun. Chasing the dog around in the hot sun. Be lucky not to pass out. He closed his eyes for a moment, breathing rapidly, the sweat rolling down his face like tears and nestling in his crew cut like gems, the broken dog dying at his feet. Colored specks of light, pulsing in rhythm with his heartbeat, floated across the darkness behind his lids. His head ached. Sometimes he wondered if he was going crazy, like now. He had meant to give the dog a burst from the ammonia flit gun, drive it back into the barn so he could leave his business card in the crack of the screen door, come back some other time and make a sale. Now look. Look at this mess. Couldn't very well leave his card now, could he? He opened his eyes. The dog lay at his feet, panting rapidly, drizzling blood from its snout. As Greg Stilson looked down, it licked his shoe humbly, as if to acknowledge that it had been bested, and then it went back to the business of dying.
"Shouldn't have torn my pants," he said to it. "Pants cost me $5, you shit-poke dog."
He had to get out of here. Wouldn't do him any good if Clem Cadiddlehopper and his wife and their 6 kids came back from town now in their Studebaker and saw Fido dying out here with the bad old salesman standing over him. He'd lose his job. The American Truthway Company didn't hire salesmen who killed dogs that belonged to Christians. Giggling nervously, Greg went back to the Mercury, got in, and backed rapidly out of the driveway. He turned east on the dirt road that ran straight as a string through the corn, and was soon cruising along at 65, leaving a dust plume 2 miles long behind him. He most assuredly didn't want to lose the job, not yet. He was making good money. In addition to the wrinkles the American Truthway Company knew about, Greg had added a few of his own that they didn't know about. He was making it now. Besides, traveling around, he got to meet a lot of people, a lot of girls. It was a good life, except he wasn't content. He drove on, his head throbbing. No, he just wasn't content. He felt that he was meant for bigger things than driving around the Midwest and selling Bibles and doctoring the commission forms in order to make an extra $2 a day. He felt that he was meant for greatness. Yes, that was it. That was surely it. A few weeks ago, he had taken some girl up in the hayloft. Her folks had been in Davenport selling a truckload of chickens. She had started off by asking if he would like a glass of lemonade, and one thing had just led to another, and after he'd had her, she said it was almost like getting diddled by a preacher, and he had slapped her. He didn't know why. He had slapped her and then left. Well, no. Actually, he had slapped her 3 or 4 times until she had cried and screamed for someone to come and help her, and then he had stopped, and somehow, he had had to use every ounce of the charm God had given him. He had made it up with her. His head had been aching then, too. The pulsing specks of brightness shooting and caroming across his field of vision. And he had tried to tell himself it was the heat. The explosive heat in the hayloft. But it wasn't just the heat that made his head ache. It was the same thing he had felt in the dooryard when the dog tore his pants. Something dark and crazy.
I'm not crazy, he said aloud in the car.
He unrolled the window swiftly, letting in summer heat and the smell of dust and corn and manure. He turned on the radio loud and caught a Patti Page song. His headache went back a little bit. It was all a matter of keeping yourself under control and keeping your record clean. If you did those things, they couldn't touch you. And he was getting better at both of those things. He no longer had the dreams about his father so often. The dreams where his father was standing above him with his hard hat cocked back on his head, bellowing,
"You're no good, Runt. You're no fucking good."
He didn't have the dreams so much because they just weren't true. He wasn't a runt anymore. Okay, he had been sick a lot as a kid, not much size, but he had gotten his growth. He was taking care of his mother. And his father was dead. His father couldn't see. He couldn't make his father eat his words because he had died in an oil derrick blowout, and he was dead. And once, just once, Greg would like to dig him up and scream into his moldering face, "You were wrong, Dad, you were wrong about me," and then give him a good kick the way he had kicked the dog. The headache was back, lowering.
"I'm not crazy," he said again below the sound of the music.
His mother had told him often that he was meant for something big, something great, and Greg believed it. It was just a matter of getting things, like slapping the girl or kicking the dog, under control and keeping his record clean. Whatever his greatness was, he would know it when it came to him. Of that, he felt quite sure. He thought of the dog again, and this time, the thought brought a bare crescent of a smile, without humor or compassion. His greatness was on the way. It might still be years ahead. He was young, sure. Nothing wrong with being young, as long as you understood you couldn't have everything all at once, as long as you believed it would come eventually. He did believe that. And God and Sonny Jesus help anyone that got in his way. Greg Stilson cocked a sunburned elbow out the window and began to whistle along with the radio. He stepped on the go pedal, walked that old Mercury up to 70, and rolled down the straight Iowa farm road toward whatever future there might be. Part 1. The Wheel of Fortune. Chapter 1. 1. The two things Sarah remembered about that night later were his run of luck at the Wheel of Fortune and the mask. But as time passed, years of it, it was the mask she thought about, when she could bring herself to think about that horrible night at all. He lived in an apartment house in Cleves Mills. Sarah got there at 7:45, parking around the corner, and buzzing up to be let in. They were taking her car tonight because Johnny's was laid up at Tibbetts Garage in Hampton, with a frozen wheel bearing or something like that. Something expensive, Johnny had told her over the phone, and then he had laughed a typical Johnny Smith laugh. Sarah would have been in tears if it had been her car, her pocketbook. She went through the foyer to the stairs, past the bulletin board that hung there. It was dotted with file cards advertising motorbikes, stereo components, typing services, and appeals from people who needed rides to Kansas or California. People who were driving to Florida and needed riders to share the driving and help pay for the gas. But tonight the board was dominated by a large placard showing a clenched fist against an angry red background suggesting fire. The one word on the poster was strike. It was late October of 1970. Johnny had the front apartment on the second floor, the penthouse, he called it, where you could stand in your tux like Ramon Navarro, a big slug of ripple wine in a balloon glass, and look down upon the vast, beating heart of Cleves Mills. Its hurrying after-show crowds, its bustling taxis, its neon signs. There are almost 7,000 stories in the Naked City. This has been one of them. Actually, Cleves Mills was mostly a main street with a stop-and-go light at the intersection. It turned into a blinker after 6 p.m. About 24 stores and a small moccasin factory. Like most of the towns surrounding Orono, where the University of Maine was, its real industry was supplying the things students consumed: beer, wine, gas, rock and roll music, fast food, dope, groceries, housing, movies. The movie house was The Shade, It showed art films and 40s nostalgia flicks when school was in. In the summertime, it reverted to Clint Eastwood spaghetti westerns. Johnny and Sarah were both out of school a year, and both were teaching at Cleves Mills High, one of the few high schools in the area that had not consolidated into a 3- or 4-town district. University faculty and administration, as well as university students, used Cleves as their bedroom, and the town had an enviable tax base. It also had a fine high school with a brand new media wing. The townies might bitch about the university crowd with their smart talk and their commie marches to end the war and their meddling in town politics, but they had never said no to the tax dollars that were paid annually on the gracious faculty homes and the apartment buildings in the area some students called Fudgy Acres and others called Sleaze Alley. Sarah rapped on his door, and Johnny's voice, oddly muffled, called, "It's open, Sarah." Frowning a little, she pushed the door open. Johnny's apartment was in total darkness, except for the fitful yellow glow of the blinker half a block up the street. The furniture was so many humped black shadows. "Johnny?" Wondering if a fuse had blown or something, she took a tentative step forward. And then the face appeared before her, floating in the darkness, a horrible face out of a nightmare. It glowed a spectral rotting green. One eye was wide open, seeming to stare at her in wounded fear. The other was squeezed shut in a sinister leer. The left half of the face, the half with the open eye, appeared to be normal, but the right half of the face was a monster, drawn and inhuman, the thick lips drawn back to reveal snaggle teeth that were also glowing. Sarah uttered a strangled little shriek and took a stumble step backward. Then the lights came on, and it was just Johnny's apartment again instead of some black limbo, Nixon on the wall trying to sell used cars, the braided rug Johnny's mother had made on the floor, the wine bottles made into candle bases. The face stopped glowing, and she saw it was a dime store Halloween mask, nothing more. Johnny's blue eye was twinkling out of the open eye hole at her. He stripped it off and stood smiling amiably at her, dressed in faded jeans and a brown sweater. "Happy Halloween, Sarah," he said. Her heart was still racing. He had really frightened her. "Very funny," she said, and turned to go. She didn't like being scared like that. He caught her in the doorway. "Hey, I'm sorry." "Well, you ought to be." She looked at him coldly, or tried to. Her anger was already melting away. He just couldn't stay mad at Johnny, that was the thing. Whether she loved him or not, a thing she was still trying to puzzle out, it was impossible to be unhappy with him for very long, or to harbor a feeling of resentment. She wondered if anyone had ever succeeded in harboring a grudge against Johnny Smith. And the thought was so ridiculous, she just had to smile. "There, that's better. Man, I thought you were going to walk out on me." "I'm not a man." He cast his eyes upon her. "So I've noticed." She was wearing a bulky fur coat, imitation raccoon or something vulgar like that, and his innocent lechery made her smile again. "In this thing you couldn't tell." "Oh yeah, I can tell," he said. He put an arm around her and kissed her. At first she wasn't going to kiss back, but of course she did. "I'm sorry I scared you," he said, and rubbed her nose companionably with his own before letting her go. He held up the mask. "I thought you'd get a kick out of it. I'm going to wear it in homeroom Friday." "Oh, Johnny, that won't be very good for discipline." "I'll muddle through somehow," he said with a grin. And the hell of it was, he would. She came to school every day wearing big, schoolmarmish glasses, her hair drawn back into a bun so severe it seemed on the verge of a scream. She wore her skirts just above the knee, in a season when most of the girls wore them just below the edges of their underpants. "And my legs are better than any of theirs," Sarah thought resentfully. She maintained alphabetical seating charts, which, by the law of averages at least, should have kept the troublemakers away from each other, and she resolutely sent unruly pupils to the assistant principal, her reasoning being that he was getting an extra $500 a year to act as ramrod, and she wasn't. And still, her days were a constant struggle with that freshman teacher demon, discipline. More disturbing, she'd begun to sense that there was a collective, unspoken jury, a kind of school consciousness, maybe, that went into deliberations over every new teacher, and that the verdict being returned on her was not so good. Johnny, on the face of it, appeared to be the antithesis of everything a good teacher should be. He ambled from class to class in an agreeable sort of daze, often showing up tardy because he had stopped to chat with someone between bells. He let the kids sit where they wanted to, so that the same face was never in the same seat from day to day, and the class thugs invariably gravitated to the back of the room. Sarah would not have been able to learn their names that way until March, but Johnny seemed to have them down pat already. He was a tall man who had a tendency to slouch, and the kids called him Frankenstein. Johnny seemed amused rather than outraged by this, and yet his classes were mostly quiet and well-behaved. There were few skippers. Sarah had a constant problem with kids cutting class, and that same jury seemed to be coming back in his favor. He was the sort of teacher who, in another 10 years, would have the school yearbook dedicated to him. She just wasn't, and sometimes wondering why drove her crazy. You want a beer before we go? Glass of wine? Anything? No, but I hope you're going well-heeled, she said, taking his arm and deciding not to be mad anymore. I always eat at least 3 hot dogs, especially when it's the last county fair of the year. They were going to Esty, 20 miles north of Cleves Mills, a town whose only dubious claim to fame was that it held absolutely the last agricultural fair of the year in New England. The fair would close Friday night on Halloween. Considering Friday's payday, I'm doing good. I got $8. Oh my God, Sarah said, rolling her eyes. I always knew if I kept myself pure, I'd meet a sugar daddy someday. He smiled and nodded. Us pimps make big money, baby. Just let me get my coat and we're off. She looked after him with exasperated affection, and the voice that had been surfacing in her mind more and more often, in the shower, while she was reading a book or prepping a class or making her supper for one, came up again like one of those 30-second public service spots on TV. He's a very nice man and all that, easy to get along with, fun, he never makes you cry. But is that love? I mean, is that all there is to it? Even when you learn to ride your two-wheeler, you had to fall off a few times and scrape both knees. Call it a rite of passage. And that was just a little thing. Gonna use the bathroom, he called to her. Uh-huh, she smiled a little. Johnny was one of those people who invariably mentioned their nature calls. God knew why. She went over to the window and looked out on Main Street. Kids were pulling into the parking lot next to O'Mike's, the local pizza and beer hangout. She suddenly wished she were back with them, one of them, with this confusing stuff behind her, or still ahead of her. The university was safe. It was a kind of never-never land where everybody, even the teachers, could be a part of Peter Pan's band and never grow up, and there would always be a Nixon or an Agnew to play Captain Hook. She had met Johnny when they had started teaching in September, but she had known his face from the ed courses they had shared. She had been pinned to a Delta Tau Delta, and none of the judgments that applied to Johnny had applied to Dan. He had been almost flawlessly handsome, witty in a sharp and restless way that always made her a trifle uncomfortable, a heavy drinker, a passionate lover. Sometimes when he drank, he turned mean. She remembered a night in Bangor's Brass Rail when that had happened. The man in the next booth had taken joking issue with something Dan had been saying about the UMO football team, and Dan had asked him if he would like to go home with his head on backward. The man had apologized, but Dan hadn't wanted an apology. He had wanted a fight. He began to make personal remarks about the woman with the other man. Sarah had put her hand on Dan's arm and asked him to stop. Dan had shaken her hand off and had looked at her with a queer, flat light in his grayish eyes that made any other word she might have spoken dry up in her throat. Eventually, Dan and the other guy went outside, and Dan beat him up. Dan had beaten him until the other man, who was in his late 30s and getting a belly, had screamed. Sarah had never heard a man scream before. She never wanted to hear it again. They had to leave quickly because the bartender saw how it was going and called the police. She would have gone home alone that night. Oh, are you sure? Her mind asked nastily. But it was 12 miles back to the campus, and the buses had stopped running at 6, and she was afraid to hitch. Dan didn't talk on the way back. He had a scratch on one cheek, just one scratch. When they got back to Hart Hall, her dorm, she told him she didn't want to see him anymore. Any way you want it, babe, he said with an indifference that had chilled her. And the second time he called after the brass rail incident, she had gone out with him. Part of her had hated herself for that. It had continued all that fall semester of her senior year. He had frightened and attracted her at the same time. He was her first real lover, and even now, 2 days shy of Halloween 1970, he had been her only real lover. She and Johnny had not been to bed. Dan had been very good. He had used her, but he had been very good. He would not take any precautions, and so she had been forced to go to the university infirmary, where she talked fumblingly about painful menstruation and got the pill. Sexually, Dan had dominated her all along. She did not have many orgasms with him, but his very roughness brought her some, and in the weeks before it had ended, she had begun to feel a mature woman's greediness for good sex, a desire that was bewilderingly intermixed with other feelings, dislike for both Dan and herself, a feeling that no sex that depended so much on humiliation and domination could really be called good sex, and self-contempt for her own inability to call a halt to a relationship that seemed based on destructive feelings. It had ended swiftly early this year. He flunked out. "Where will you be going?" she asked him timidly, sitting on his roomie's bed as he threw things into two suitcases. She had wanted to ask other more personal questions. "Will you be near here? Will you take a job? Take night classes? Is there a place for me in your plans?" That question, above all others, she had not been able to ask, because she wasn't prepared for any answer. The answer he gave to her one neutral question was shocking enough. "Vietnam, I guess." "What?" He reached onto a shelf, thumbed briefly through the papers there, and tossed her a letter. It was from the induction center in Bangor, an order to report for his physical exam.
"Can't you get out of it?"
"No. Maybe. I don't know." He lit a cigarette. "I don't think I even want to try." She had stared at him, shocked. "I'm tired of this scene. College and get a job and find a little wifey. You've been applying for the little wifey spot, I guess. And don't think I haven't thought it over. It wouldn't work. You know it wouldn't, and so do I. We don't fit, Sarah." She had fled then, all her questions answered, and she never saw him again. She saw his roommate a few times. He got 3 letters from Dan between January and June. He was inducted and sent down south somewhere for basic training. And that was the last the roommate had heard. It was the last Sarah Bracknell heard, too. At first she thought she was going to be okay. All those sad, torchy songs, the ones you always seem to hear on the car radio after midnight, they didn't apply to her. Or the cliches about the end of the affair or the crying jags. She didn't pick up a guy on the rebound or start doing the bars. Most evenings that spring she spent studying quietly in her dorm room. It was a relief. It wasn't messy. It was only after meeting Johnny, at a freshman mixer dance last month, they were both chaperoning, purely by luck of the draw, that she realized what a horror her last semester at school had been. It was the kind of thing you couldn't see when you were in it. It was too much a part of you. 2 donkeys meet at a hitching rail in a western town. One of them is a town donkey with nothing on his back but a saddle. The other is a prospector's donkey, loaded down with packs, camping and cooking gear, and 4 50-pound sacks of ore. His back is bent into a concertina shape from the weight. The town donkey says, "It's quite a load you got there." And the prospector's donkey says, "What load?" In retrospect, it was the emptiness that horrified her. It had been 5 months of Chain Stokes respiration, 8 months if you counted this summer, when she took a small apartment on Flag Street in Vesey and did nothing but apply for teaching jobs and read paperback novels. She got up, ate breakfast, went out to class or to whatever job interviews she had scheduled, came home, ate, took a nap. The naps were sometimes 4 hours long. Ate again, read until 11:30 or so, watched Cavett until she got sleepy, went to bed. She could not remember thinking during that period. Life was routine. Sometimes there was a vague sort of ache in her loins, an unfulfilled ache, she believed the lady novelist sometimes called it, and for this she would either take a cold shower or a douche. After a while, the douches grew painful, and this gave her a bitter, absent sort of satisfaction. During this period, she would congratulate herself from time to time on how adult she was being about the whole thing. She hardly ever thought about Dan. Dan who? Haha. Later she realized that for 8 months she had thought of nothing or no one else. The whole country had gone through a spasm of shudders during those 8 months, but she had hardly noticed. The marches, the cops in their crash helmets and gas masks, the mounting attacks on the press by Agnew, the Kent State shootings, the summer of violence as blacks and radical groups took to the streets. Those things might have happened on some TV late show. Sarah was totally wrapped up in how wonderfully she had gotten over Dan, how well she was adjusting, and how relieved she was to find that everything was just fine. What load? Then she had started at Cleves Mills High, and that had been a personal upheaval, being on the other side of the desk after 16 years as a professional student. Meeting Johnny Smith at that mixer, and with an absurd name like John Smith, could he be completely for real? Coming out of herself enough to see the way he was looking at her, not lecherously, but with a good, healthy appreciation for the way she looked in the light gray knitted dress she had worn. He had asked her out to a movie. Citizen Kane was playing at the Shade, and she said okay. They had a good time, and she was thinking to herself, no fireworks. She had enjoyed his kiss goodnight and had thought, he's sure no Errol Flynn. He had kept her smiling with his line of patter, which was outrageous, and she had thought, he wants to be Henny Youngman when he grows up. Later that evening, sitting in the bedroom of her apartment and watching Betty Davis play a bitchy career woman on the late movie, some of these thoughts had come back to her, and she paused with her teeth sunk into an apple, rather shocked at her own unfairness. And a voice that had been silent for the best part of a year, not so much the voice of conscience as that of perspective, spoke up abruptly. What you mean is, he sure isn't Dan, isn't that it? No, she assured herself, not just rather shocked now. I don't think about Dan at all anymore. That was a long time ago. Diapers, the voice replied. That was a long time ago. Dan left yesterday. She suddenly realized she was sitting in an apartment by herself late at night, eating an apple and watching a movie on TV that she cared nothing about, and doing it all because it was easier than thinking. Thinking was so boring, really, when all you had to think about was yourself and your lost love. Very shocked now. She had burst into tears. She had gone out with Johnny the second and third time he asked, too, and that was also a revelation of exactly what she had become. She couldn't very well say that she had another date because it wasn't so. She was a smart, pretty girl, and she'd been asked out a lot after the affair with Dan ended, but the only date she had accepted were hamburger dates at the Den with Dan's roomie, and she realized now, her disgust tempered with rueful humor, that she had only gone on those completely innocuous dates in order to pump the poor guy about Dan. What load? Most of her college girlfriends had dropped over the horizon after graduation. Betty Hackman was with the Peace Corps in Africa, to the utter dismay of her wealthy old-line Bangor parents. And sometimes Sarah wondered what the Ugandans must make of Betty with her white, impossible-to-tan skin and ash-blonde hair and cool sorority good looks. Deanie Stubbs was at grad school in Houston. Rachel Juergens had married her fella, and was currently gestating somewhere in the wilds of western Massachusetts. Slightly dazed, Sarah had been forced to the conclusion that Johnny Smith was the first new friend she had made in a long, long time, and she had been her senior high school class's Miss Popularity. She had accepted dates from a couple of the other Cleves teachers, just to keep things in perspective. One of them was Gene Sadecki, the new math man, but obviously a veteran bore. The other, George Rounds, had immediately tried to make her. She had slapped his face, and the next day, he'd had the gall to wink at her as they passed in the hall. But Johnny was fun, easy to be with, and he did attract her sexually. Just how strongly, she couldn't honestly say, at least not yet. A week ago, after the Friday they'd had off for the October Teachers Convention in Waterville, he'd invited her back to his apartment for a home-cooked spaghetti dinner. While the sauce simmered, he had dashed around the corner to get some wine and had come back with 2 bottles of Apple Zapple. Like announcing his bathroom calls, It was somehow Johnny's style. After the meal, they had watched TV, and that had turned to necking, and God knew what that might have turned into if a couple of his friends, instructors from the university, hadn't turned up with a faculty position paper on academic freedom. They wanted Johnny to look it over and see what he thought. He had done so, but with noticeably less goodwill than was usual with him. She had noticed that with a warm, secret delight, and the ache in her own loins, the unfulfilled ache, had also delighted her, and that night she hadn't killed it with a douche. She turned away from the window and walked over to the sofa where Johnny had left the mask. "Happy Halloween," she snorted, and laughed a little. "What?" Johnny called out. "I said, if you don't come pretty quick, I'm going without you." "Be right out." "Swell." She ran a finger over the Jekyll and Hyde mask. Kindly Dr. Jekyll, the left half. Ferocious subhuman Hyde, the right half. Where will we be by Thanksgiving, she wondered. Or by Christmas. The thought sent a funny, excited little thrill shooting through her. She liked him. He was a perfectly ordinary, sweet man. She looked down at the mask again. Horrible hide growing out of Jekyll's face like a lumpy carcinoma. It had been treated with fluorescent paint so it would glow in the dark. What's ordinary? Nothing. Nobody. Not really. If he was so ordinary, how could he be planning to wear something like that into his homeroom and still be confident of keeping order? And how can the kids call him Frankenstein and still respect and like him? What's ordinary? Johnny came out, brushing through the beaded curtain that divided the bedroom and bathroom off from the living room. If he wants me to go to bed with him tonight, I think I'm going to say okay. And it was a warm thought, like coming home. What are you grinning about? Nothing, she said, tossing the mask back to the sofa. No, really. Was it something good? Johnny, she said, putting a hand on his chest and standing on tiptoe to kiss him lightly. Some things will never be told. Come on, let's go. 2. They paused downstairs in the foyer while he buttoned his denim jacket, and she found her eyes drawn again to the strike poster with its clenched fist and flaming background. There'll be another student strike this year, he said, following her eyes. The war? That's only going to be part of it this time. Vietnam and the fight over ROTC and Kent State have activated more students than ever before. I doubt if there's ever been a time when there were so few grunts taking up space at the university. What do you mean, grunts? Kids just studying to make grades with no interest in the system except that it provides them with a $10,000 a year job when they get out. A grunt is a student who gives a shit about nothing except his sheepskin. That's over. Most of them are awake. There are going to be some big changes. Is that important to you, even though you're out? He drew himself up. Madam, I am an alumnus. Smith, class of 70. Philistines to dear old Maine. She smiled. Come on, let's go. I want to ride on the whip before they shut it down for the night. Very good, he said, taking her arm. I just happen to have your car parked around the corner. And $8. The evening fairly glitters before us. The night was overcast but not rainy, mild for late October. Overhead, a quarter moon was struggling to make it through the cloud cover. Johnny slipped an arm around her, and she moved closer to him. You know, I think an awful lot of you, Sarah. His tone was almost offhand, but only almost. Her heart slowed a little, and then made speed for a dozen beats or so. Really? I guess this Dan guy, he hurt you, didn't he? I don't know what he did to me, she said truthfully. The yellow blinker, a block behind them now, made their shadows appear and disappear on the concrete in front of them. Johnny appeared to think this over. I wouldn't want to do that, he said finally. No, I know that. But Johnny, give it time. Yeah, he said, time. We've got that, I guess. And that would come back to her, awake and even more strongly in her dreams, in tones of inexpressible bitterness and loss. They went around the corner, and Johnny opened the passenger door for her. He went around and got in behind the wheel. You cold? No, she said. It's a great night for it. It is, he agreed, and pulled away from the curb. Her thoughts went back to that ridiculous mask. Half Jekyll with Johnny's blue eye visible behind the widened O eye socket of the surprised doctor.
Say, that's some cocktail I invented last night, but I don't think they'll be able to move it in the bars.
And that side was all right because you could see a bit of Johnny inside. It was the hide part that had scared her silly, because that eye was closed down to a slit. It could have been anybody. Anybody at all. Dan, for instance.
But by the time they reached the Esty Fairgrounds, where the naked bulbs of the midway twinkled in the darkness, and the long spokes of the Ferris wheel neon revolved up and down, she'd forgotten the mask. She was with her guy, and they were going to have a good time.
3. They walked up to Midway hand in hand, not talking much, and Sarah found herself reliving the county fairs of her youth. She had grown up in South Paris, a paper town in western Maine, and the big fair had been the one in Freiburg. For Johnny, a Pownall boy, it probably would have been Topsham. But they were all the same, really, and they hadn't changed much over the years. You parked your car in a dirt parking lot and paid your $2 at the gate, and when you were barely inside the fairgrounds, you could smell hot dogs, frying peppers and onions, bacon, cotton candy, sawdust, and sweet, aromatic horse shit. You heard the heavy, chain-driven rumble of the baby roller coaster, the one they called the Wild Mouse. You heard the popping of 22s in the shooting galleries, the tinny blare of the bingo caller from the PA system strung around the big tent, filled with long tables and folding chairs from the local mortuary. Rock and roll music vied with the calliope for supremacy. You heard the steady cry of the barkers. Two shots for two bits. Win one of these stuffed doggies for your baby. Hey, hey, over here. Pitch till you win. It didn't change. It turns you into a kid again, willing and eager to be suckered.
Here, she said, stopping him. The whip, the whip.
Of course, Johnny said comfortingly. He passed the woman in the ticket cage a dollar bill, and she pushed back two red tickets and two dimes with barely a glance up from her photo play.
What do you mean, of course? Why are you of coursing me in that tone of voice?
He shrugged. His face was much too innocent. It wasn't what you said, John Smith. It was how you said it. The ride had stopped. Passengers were getting off and streaming past them, mostly teenagers in blue Melton CPO shirts or open parkas. Johnny led her up the wooden ramp and surrendered their tickets to the whip starter, who looked like the most bored sentient creature in the universe. Nothing, he said, as the starter settled them into one of the little round shells and snapped the safety bar into place. It's just that these cars are on little circular tracks, right?
Right.
And the little circular tracks are embedded on a large circular dish that spins around and around, right?
Right.
Well, when this ride is going full steam, the little car we're sitting in whips around on its little circular track and sometimes develops up to 7G, which is only 5 less than the astronauts get when they lift off from Cape Kennedy. And I knew this kid. Johnny was leaning solemnly over her now. Oh, here comes one of your big lies, Sarah said uneasily. When this kid was 5, he fell down the front steps and put a tiny hairline fracture in his spine at the top of his neck. Then, 10 years later, he went on the whip at Topsham Fair, and he shrugged and then patted her hand sympathetically. But you'll probably be okay, Sarah.
Oh, I want to get off.
And the whip whirled them away, slamming the fair and the midway into a tilted blur of lights and faces, and she shrieked and laughed and began to pummel him.
Hairline fracture, she shouted at him. I'll give you a hairline fracture when we get off this, you liar. Do you feel anything giving in your neck yet? He inquired sweetly. Oh, you liar.
They whirled around faster and faster, and as they snapped past the ride starter for the 10th, 15th time, he leaned over and kissed her, and the car whistled around on his track, pressing their lips together in something that was hot and exciting and skin tight. Then the ride was slowing down. Their car clacked around on its track more reluctantly, and finally came to a swaying, swinging stop. They got out, and Sarah squeezed his neck.
Hairline fracture, you ass, she whispered.
A fat lady in blue slacks and penny loafers was passing them. Johnny spoke to her, jerking a thumb back toward Sarah.
That girl is bothering me, ma'am. If you see a policeman, would you tell him? You young people think you're smart, the fat lady said disdainfully. She waddled away toward the bingo tent, holding her purse more tightly under her arm. Sarah giggled helplessly. You're impossible.
I'll come to a bad end, Johnny agreed. My mother always said so.
They walked up to Midway side by side, waiting for the world to stop making unstable motions before their eyes and under their feet.
She's pretty religious, your mom, isn't she? Sarah asked.
She's as Baptist as you can get, Johnny agreed. But she's okay. She keeps it under control. She can't resist passing me a few tracks when I'm at home, but that's her thing. Daddy and I put up with it. I used to try to get on her case about it. I'd ask her, who the heck was in Nod for Cain to go live with if his dad and mom were the first people on Earth? Stuff like that. But I decided it was sort of mean and quit it. 2 years ago, I thought Eugene McCarthy could save the world, and at least the Baptists don't have Jesus running for president.
Your father's not religious?
Johnny laughed. I don't know about that, but he's sure no Baptist. After a moment's thought, he added, Dad's a carpenter, as if that explained it. She smiled.
What would your mother think if she knew you were seeing a lapsed Catholic?
Ask me to bring you home, Johnny said promptly, so she could slip you a few tracks. She stopped, still holding his hand.
Would you like to bring me to your house? She asked, looking at him closely.
Johnny's long, pleasant face became serious.
Yeah, he said. I'd like you to meet them, and vice versa.
Why?
Don't you know why? He asked her gently, and suddenly her throat closed, and her head throbbed as if she might cry, and she squeezed his hand tightly. Oh, Johnny, I do like you.
I like you even more than that, he said seriously.
Take me on the Ferris wheel, she demanded suddenly, smiling. No more talk like this until she had a chance to consider it, to think where it might be leading. I want to go up high where we can see everything.
Can I kiss you at the top?
Twice, if you're quick.
He allowed her to lead him to the ticket booth, where he surrendered another dollar bill. As he paid, he told her, When I was in high school, I knew this kid who worked at the fair, and he said most of the guys who put these rides together are dead drunk, and they leave off all sorts of...
Go to hell, she said merrily. Nobody lives forever.
But everybody tries. You ever notice that? He said, following her into one of the swaying gondolas. As a matter of fact, he got to kiss her several times at the top, with the October wind ruffling their hair and the midway spread out below them like a glowing clock face in the dark. 4. After the Ferris wheel, they did the carousel, even though he told her quite honestly that he felt like a horse's ass. His legs were so long that he could have stood astride one of the plaster horses. She told him maliciously that she had known a girl in high school who had had a weak heart, except nobody knew she had a weak heart, and she had gotten on the carousel with her boyfriend and...
Someday you'll be sorry, he told her with quiet sincerity. A relationship based on lies is no good, Sarah.
She gave him a very moist raspberry. After the carousel came the mirror maze, a very good mirror maze, as a matter of fact. It made her think of the one in Bradbury's Something Wicked This Way Comes, where the little old lady schoolteacher almost got lost forever. She could see Johnny in another part of it, fumbling around, waving to her. Dozens of Johnnies, dozens of Sarahs. They bypassed each other, flickered around non-Euclidean angles, and seemed to disappear. She made left turns, right turns, bumped her nose on panes of clear glass, and got giggling helplessly, partly in a nervous claustrophobic reaction. One of the mirrors turned her into a squat Tolkien dwarf. Another created the apotheosis of teenage gangliness, with shins a quarter of a mile long. At last they escaped, and he got them a couple of fried hot dogs, and a Dixie cup filled with greasy French fries that tasted the way French fries hardly ever do once you've gotten past your 15th year. They passed a cooch joint. Three girls stood out front in sequin skirts and bras. They were shimmying to an old Jerry Lee Lewis tune while the barker hawked them through a microphone.
Come on over, baby, Jerry Lee blared, his piano boogieing frankly across the sawdust-sprinkled arcades. Come on over, baby. Baby got the bull by the horns. We ain't faking. Whole lot of shaking going on.
Club Playboy, Johnny marveled and laughed. There used to be a place like this down at Harrison Beach.
The barkeep used to swear the girls could take the glasses right off your nose with their hands tied behind their backs.
Sounds like an interesting way to get a social disease, Sarah said, and Johnny roared with laughter.
Behind them, the barker's amplified voice grew hollow with distance, counterpointed by Jerry Lee's pumping piano, music like some mad, dented hot rod that was too tough to die, rumbling out of the dead and silent 50s like an omen.
Come on, men, come on over. Don't be shy, because these girls sure aren't, not in the least little bit. It's all on the inside. Your education isn't complete until you've seen the Club Playboy show.
Don't you want to go back and finish your education, she asked.
He smiled. I finished my basic coursework on that subject some time ago. I guess I can wait a while to get my PhD.
She glanced at her watch. Hey, it's getting late, Johnny, and tomorrow's a school day.
Yeah, but at least it's Friday.
She sighed, thinking of her fifth period study hall and her seventh period new fiction class, both of them impossibly rowdy. They had worked their way back to the main part of the midway. The crowd was thinning. The tilt-a-whirl had shut down for the evening. Two workmen with unfiltered cigarettes jutting out of the corners of their mouths were covering the wild mouse with a tarpaulin. The man in the pitch till you win was turning off his lights.
You doing anything Saturday? He asked, suddenly diffident.
I know it's short notice, but I have plans, she said.
Oh.
And she couldn't bear his crestfallen expression. It was really too mean to tease him about that.
I'm doing something with you.
You are?
Oh, you are. Say, that's good.
He grinned at her and she grinned back. The voice in her mind, which was sometimes as real to her as the voice of another human being, suddenly spoke up.
You're feeling good again, Sarah. Feeling happy. Isn't it fine?
Yes, it is, she said. She went up on tiptoe and kissed him quickly. She made herself go on before she could chicken out.
It gets pretty lonely down there in Beezy sometimes, you know. Maybe I could sort of spend the night with you?
He looked at her with warm thoughtfulness, and with a speculation that made her tingle deep inside.
Would that be what you want, Sarah?
She nodded.
Very much what I want.
All right, he said, and put an arm around her.
Are you sure? Sarah asked a little shyly.
I'm just afraid you'll change your mind.
I won't, Johnny.
He hugged her tighter against him.
Then it's my lucky night.
They were passing the Wheel of Fortune as he said it, and Sarah would later remember that it was the only booth still open on that side of the midway for 30 yards in either direction. The man behind the counter had just finished sweeping the packed dirt inside for any spare dimes that might have fallen from the playing board during the night's action. Probably his last chore before closing up, she thought. Behind him was his large spoked wheel, outlined by tiny electric bulbs. He must have heard Johnny's remark, because he went into his pitch more or less automatically, his eyes still searching the dirt floor of his booth for the gleam of silver.
Hey, 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 if you feel lucky, mister, spin the Wheel of Fortune, turn dimes into dollars, it's all in the wheel, try your luck. One thin dime sets this Wheel of Fortune in motion.
Johnny swung back toward the sound of his voice.
Johnny?
I feel lucky, just like the man said.
He smiled down at her.
Unless you mind.
No, go ahead. Just don't take too long.
He looked at her again in that frankly speculative way that made her feel a little weak, wondering how it would be with him. Her stomach did a slow rollover that made her feel a bit nauseated with sudden sexual longing.
No, not long. He looked at the pitchman.
The midway behind them was almost completely empty now, and as the overcast had melted off above them, it had turned chilly. The three of them were puffing white vapor as they breathed.
Try your luck, young man.
Yes.
He had switched all his cash to his front pocket when they arrived at the fair, and now he pulled out the remains of his $8. It came to $1.85. The playing board was a strip of yellow plastic with numbers and odds painted on it in squares. It looked a bit like a roulette board, but Johnny saw immediately that the odds here would have turned a Las Vegas roulette player gray. A trip combination paid off at only 2-1. There were two house numbers, 0 and 00. He pointed this out to the pitchman, who only shrugged.
You want Vegas? Go to Vegas. What can I say?
But Johnny's good humor tonight was unshakable.
Things had gotten off to a poor start with that mask, but it had been all upbeat from there. In fact, it was the best night he could remember in years. Maybe the best night ever. He looked at Sarah. Her color was high, her eyes sparkling. What do you say, Sarah? She shook her head. It's Greek to me. What do? Play a number, or red-black, or odd-even, or a 10-number series. They all pay differently. He gazed at the pitchman, who gazed back blandly. At least they should. Play black, she said. It is sort of exciting, isn't it? Black, he said, and dropped his odd dime on the black square. The pitchman stared at the single dime on his expansive playboard and sighed. Heavy plunger. He turned to the wheel. Johnny's hand wandered absently to his forehead and touched it. Wait, he said abruptly. He pushed one of his quarters onto the square, reading 11 to 20.
That's it?
Sure, Johnny said. The pitchman gave the wheel a twist, and it spun inside its circle of lights, red and black merging. Johnny absently rubbed at his forehead. The wheel began to slow, and now they could hear the metronome-like tick-tock of the small wooden clapper sliding past the pins that divided the numbers. It reached 8, 9, seemed about to stop on 10, and slipped into the 11th slot with a final click and came to rest.
The lady loses, the gentleman wins, the pitchman said.
You won, Johnny?
Seems like it, Johnny said as the pitchman added two quarters to his original one.
Sarah gave a little squeal, barely noticing as the pitchman swept the dime away.
Told you, my lucky night, Johnny said. Twice is luck, once is just a fluke, the pitchman remarked. Hey, hey, hey.
Go again, Johnny, she said.
All right, just as it is for me. Let it ride?
Yes. The pitchman spun the wheel again, and as it slid around, Sarah murmured quietly to him. Aren't all these carnival wheels supposed to be fixed?
They used to be. Now the state inspects them, and they just rely on their outrageous odds system.
The wheel had slowed to its final unwinding tick-tock. The pointer passed 10 and entered Johnny's trip, still slowing. Come on, come on, Sarah cried. A couple of teenagers on their way out paused to watch. The wooden clapper, moving very slowly now past 16 and 17, then came to a stop on 18.
Gentleman wins again.
The pitchman added 6 more quarters to Johnny's pile.
You're rich,
Sarah gloated, and kissed him on the cheek.
You're streaking, fella, the pitchman agreed enthusiastically. Nobody quits a hot stick, hey, hey, hey.
Should I go again? Johnny asked her. Why not?
Yeah, go ahead, man,
one of the teenagers said. A button on his jacket bore the face of Jimi Hendrix.
That guy took me for $4 tonight. Love to see him take a beating.
You too, then, Johnny told Sarah. He gave her the odd quarter off his stack of 9. After a moment's hesitation, she laid it down on 21. Single numbers paid off 10-1 on a hit, the board announced.
You're riding the middle trip, right, fella?
Johnny looked down at the 8 quarters stacked on the board, and then he began to rub his forehead again as if he felt the beginnings of a headache. Suddenly, he swept the quarters off the board and jingled them in his 2 cupped hands. No, spin for the lady. I'll watch this one. She looked at him puzzled. Johnny? He shrugged. Just a feeling. The pitchman rolled his eyes in a heaven-give-me-strength-to-bear-these-fools gesture and set his wheel going again. It spun, slowed, and stopped on 00.
House number,
the pitchman chanted, and Sarah's quarter disappeared into his apron. Is that fair, Johnny? Sarah asked, hurt. 00 and 00 only pay the house, he said. Then you were smart to take your money off the board.
I guess I was. You want me to spin this wheel or go for coffee? The pitchman asked.
Spin it, Johnny said, and put his quarters down in 2 stacks of 4 on the 3rd trip. As the wheel buzzed around in its cage of lights, Sarah asked Johnny, never taking her eyes from the spin, how much can a place like this take in on one night? The teenagers had been joined by a quartet of older people, 2 men and 2 women. A man with the build of a construction worker said,
anywheres from $500 to $700.
The pitchman rolled his eyes again.
Oh, man, I wish you was right, he said. Hey, don't give me that poor mouth, the man who looked like a construction worker said. I used to work this scam 20 years ago.
$500 to $700 a night. $2,000 on a Saturday, easy. And that's running a straight wheel.
Johnny kept his eyes on the wheel, which was now spinning slowly enough to read the individual numbers as they flashed past. It flashed past 0 and 00, through the first trip, slowing, through the second trip, still slowing.
Too much legs, man, one of the teenagers said.
Wait, Johnny said in a peculiar tone of voice. Sarah glanced at him, and his long, pleasant face looked oddly strained, his blue eyes darker than usual, far away, distant. The pointer stopped on 30 and came to rest.
Hot stick, hot stick, the pitchman chanted resignedly, as a little crowd behind Johnny and Sarah uttered a cheer. The man who looked like a construction worker clapped Johnny on the back hard enough to make him stagger a bit. The pitchman reached into the Roy Tan box under the counter and dropped 4 singles beside Johnny's 8 quarters.
Enough? Sarah asked.
One more, Johnny said. If I win, this guy paid for our fare and your gas. If I lose, we're out $50 or so.
Hey, 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 the pitchman chanted.
He was brightening up now, getting his rhythm back. Get it down where you want it down. Step right up, you other folks. This ain't no spectator sport. Round and round she's gonna go, and where she's gonna stop ain't nobody knows.
The man who looked like a construction worker and the 2 teenagers stepped up beside Johnny and Sarah. After a moment's consultation, the teenagers produced $50 in change between them and dropped it on the middle trip. The man who looked like a construction worker, who introduced himself as Steve Bernhardt, put $1 on the square marked even.
What about you, buddy? The pitchman asked Johnny. You gonna play it as it lays?
Yes, Johnny said.
Oh, man, one of the teenagers said. That's tempting fate.
I guess, Johnny said, and Sarah smiled at him. Bernhardt gave Johnny a speculative glance and suddenly switched his dollar to his 3rd trip.
What the hell, sighed the teenager who had told Johnny he was tempting fate. He switched the 50 cents he and his friend had come up with to the same trip.
All the eggs in one basket, the pitchman chanted. That how you want it?
The players stood silent and affirmative. A couple of roustabouts had drifted over to watch, one of them with a lady friend. There was now quite a respectable little knot of people in front of the Wheel of Fortune concession in the darkening arcade. The pitchman gave the wheel a mighty spin. 12 pairs of eyes watched it revolve. Sarah found herself looking at Johnny again, thinking how strange his face was in this bold yet somehow furtive lighting. She thought of the mask again. Jekyll and Hyde, odd and even. Her stomach turned over again, making her feel a little weak. The wheel slowed, began to tick. The teenagers began to shout at it, urging it onward.
Little more, baby. Steve Bernhardt cajoled it. Little more, honey.
The wheel ticked into the 3rd trip and came to a stop on 24. A cheer went up from the crowd again.
Johnny, you did it! You did it! Sarah cried.
The pitchman whistled through his teeth in disgust and paid off. $1 for the teenagers, 2 for Bernhardt, a 10 and 2 ones for Johnny. He now had $18 in front of him on the board.
Hot stick, hot stick, hey, hey, hey! One more, buddy. This wheel's your friend tonight.
Johnny looked at Sarah. Up to you, Johnny. But she felt suddenly uneasy.
Go on, man, the teenager with the Jimi Hendrix button urged. I'd love to see this guy get a beating.
Okay, Johnny said. Last time.
Get it down where you want it down.
They all looked at Johnny, who stood thoughtful for a moment, rubbing his forehead. His usually good-humored face was still and serious and composed. He was looking at the wheel in its cage of lights, and his fingers worked steadily at the smooth skin over his right eye.
As is, he said finally.
A little speculative murmur from the crowd.
Oh, man, that is really tempting it.
He's hot,
Bernhardt said doubtfully. He glanced back at his wife, who shrugged to show her complete mystification.
I'll tag along with you, long, tall, and ugly.
The teenager with the button glanced at his friend, who shrugged and nodded.
Okay, he said, turning back to the pitchman. We'll stick too.
The wheel spun. Behind them, Sarah heard one of the roustabouts bet the other $5 against the 3rd trip coming up again. Her stomach did another forward roll, but this time it didn't stop. It just went on somersaulting over and over, and she became aware that she was getting sick. Cold sweat stood out on her face. The wheel began to slow in the 1st trip, and one of the teenagers flapped his hands in disgust. but he didn't move away. It ticked past 11, 12, 13. The pitchman looked happy at last. Tick, tock, tick, 14, 15, 16. It's going through, Bernhard said. There was awe in his voice. The pitchman looked at his wheel as if he wished he could just reach out and stop it. It clicked past 20, 21, and settled to a stop in the slot marked 22. There was another shout of triumph from the crowd, which had now grown almost to 20. All the people left at the fair were gathered here, it seemed. Faintly, Sarah heard the roustabout who had lost his bet grumble something about shit-ass luck as he paid off. Her head thumped. Her legs felt suddenly horribly unsteady, the muscles trembling and untrustworthy. She blinked her eyes rapidly several times and got only a nauseating instant of vertigo for her pains. The world seemed to tilt up at a skewed angle, as if they were still on the whip, and then slowly settled back down. I got a bad hot dog, she thought dismally. That's what you get for trying your luck at the county fair, Sarah.
Hey, 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 the pitchman said without much enthusiasm and paid off.
$2 for the teenagers, $4 for Steve Bernhardt, and then a bundle for Johnny. 3 tens, a 5, and a 1. The pitchman was not overjoyed, but he was sanguine. If the tall, skinny man with the good-looking blonde tried the third trip again, the pitchman would almost surely gather back in everything he had paid out. It wasn't the skinny man's money until it was off the board. And if he walked, well, he'd cleared $1,000 on the wheel just today. He could afford to pay out a little tonight. The word would get around that Saul Drummore's wheel had been hit, and tomorrow play would be heavier than ever. A winner was a good ad.
Lay him down where you want him down, he chanted.
Several of the others had moved up to the board and were putting down dimes and quarters, but the pitchman looked only at his money player.
What do you say, fella? Want to shoot the moon?
Johnny looked down at Sarah. What do you... Hey, are you all right? You're white as a ghost. My stomach, she said, managing a smile. I think it was my hot dog. Can we go home?
Sure, you bet.
He was gathering the wad of wrinkled bills up from the board when his eyes happened on the wheel again. The warm concern for her that had been in them faded out. They seemed to darken again, become speculative in a cold way. He's looking at that wheel the way a little boy would look at his own private ant colony, Sarah thought. Just a minute, he said. All right, Sarah answered, but she felt lightheaded now as well as sick to her stomach, and there were rumblings in her lower belly that she didn't like. Not the back door trots, Lord, please, she thought. He can't be content until he's lost it all back. And then with strange certainty, but he's not gonna lose.
What do you say, buddy? The pitchman asked. On or off, in or out? Shit or get, one of the roustabouts said, and there was nervous laughter.
Sarah's head swam. Johnny suddenly shoved bills and quarters up to the corner of the board.
What are you doing? The pitchman asked, genuinely shocked.
The whole wad on 19, Johnny said. Sarah wanted to moan and bit it back. The crowd murmured.
Don't push it, Steve Bernhardt said in Johnny's ear.
Johnny didn't answer. He was staring at the wheel with something like indifference. His eyes seemed almost violet. There was a sudden jingling sound that Sarah at first thought must be in her own ears. Then she saw that the others who had put money down were sweeping it back off the board again, leaving Johnny to make his play alone.
No, she found herself wanting to shout. Not like that. Not alone. It isn't fair.
She bit down on her lips. She was afraid that she might throw up if she opened her mouth. Her stomach was very bad now. Johnny's pile of winnings sat alone under the naked lights. $54. And the single number payoff was 10 for 1. The pitchman wet his lips.
Mister, the state says I'm not supposed to take any single number bets over $2.
Come on, Bernhardt growled.
You aren't supposed to take trip bets over 10. You just let the guy bet 18. What is it? Your ball's starting to sweat?
No, it's just... Come on, Johnny said abruptly. One way or the other. My girl's sick. The pitchman sized up the crowd. The crowd looked back at him with hostile eyes. It was bad. They didn't understand that the guy was just throwing his money away, and he was trying to restrain him. Fuck it. The crowd wasn't going to like it either way. Let the guy do his headstand and lose his money, so he could shut down for the night.
Well, he said, As long as none of you use is state inspectors.
He turned to his wheel.
Round and round she's gonna go, and where she's gonna stop ain't nobody knows.
He spun, sending the numbers into an immediate blur. For a time that seemed much longer than it actually could have been, there was no sound but the whirring of the Wheel of Fortune, the night wind rippling a swatch of canvas somewhere, and the sick thump in Sarah's own head. In her mind, she begged Johnny to put his arm around her, but he only stood quietly, with his hands on the playing board and his eyes on the wheel, which seemed determined to spin forever. At last it slowed enough for her to be able to read the numbers, and she saw 19, the 1 and 9 painted bright red on a black background. Up and down, up and down. The wheel's smooth whir broke into a steady ticka, ticka, ticka that was very loud in the stillness. Now the numbers marched past the pointer with slowing deliberation. One of the roustabouts called out in wonder, "By the Jesus, it's going to be close anyway." Johnny stood calmly, watching the wheel, and now it seemed to her, although it might have been the sickness, which was now rolling through her belly in gripping peristaltic waves, that his eyes were almost black. Jekyll and Hyde, she thought, and was suddenly senselessly afraid of him. Ticka, ticka, ticka. The wheel clicked into the second trip, past 15 and 16, clicked over 17, and after an instant's hesitation, 18 as well. With a final tick, the pointer dropped into the 19 slot. The crowd held its breath. The wheel revolved slowly, bringing the pointer up against the small pin between 19 and 20. For a quarter of a second, it seemed that the pin could not hold the pointer in the 19 slot, that the last of its dying velocity would carry it over to 20. Then the wheel rebounded, its force spent, and came to rest. For a moment, there was no sound from the crowd, no sound at all. Then one of the teenagers, soft and awed, "Hey, man, you just won $540. Steve Bernhardt, "I've never seen a run like that. Never." Then the crowd cheered. Johnny was slapped on the back, pummeled. People brushed by Sarah to get at him, to touch him. And for the moment they were separated, she felt miserable, raw panic, strengthless. She was butted this way and that, her stomach rolling crazily. A dozen after-images of the wheel whirled blackly before her eyes. A moment later, Johnny was with her, and she saw with weak gladness that it really was Johnny, and not the composed, mannequin-like figure that had watched the wheel on its last spin. He looked confused and concerned about her. "Baby, I'm sorry," he said, and she loved him for that. "I'm okay," she answered, not knowing if she was or not. The pitchman cleared his throat.
"The wheel shut down," he said. "The wheel shut down."
An accepting, ill-tempered rumble from the crowd. The pitchman looked at Johnny.
"I'll have to give you a check, young gentleman. I don't keep that much cash in the booth."
"Sure, anything," Johnny said. "Just make it quick. The lady here really is sick."
"Sure, a check," Steve Bernhardt said with infinite contempt. "He'll give you a check that'll bounce as high as the WGAN Tall Tower, and he'll be down in Florida for the winter." "My dear sir," the pitchman began, "I assure you—" "I'll go assure your mother. Maybe she'll believe you," Bernhardt said.
He suddenly reached over the playing board and groped beneath the counter.
"Hey," the pitchman yelled, "this is robbery."
The crowd did not appear impressed with his claim.
"Please," Sarah muttered. Her head was whirling.
"I don't care about the money," Johnny said suddenly. "Let us buy, please. The lady's sick."
"Oh, man," the teenager with the Jimi Hendrix button said. But he and his buddy drew reluctantly aside.
"No, Johnny," Sarah said, although she was only holding back from vomiting by an act of will now. "Get your money."
$500 was Johnny's salary for 3 weeks.
"Pay off, you cheap tin horn," Bernhardt roared.
He brought up the Roy Tan cigar box from under the counter, pushed it aside without even looking inside it, groped again, and this time came up with a steel lockbox painted industrial green. He slammed it down on the playboard.
"If there ain't $540 in there, I'll eat my own shirt in front of all these people." He dropped a hard, heavy hand on Johnny's shoulder. "You just wait a minute, sonny. You're gonna have your payday or my name's not Steve Bernhardt. Really, sir, I don't have that much. You pay, Steve Bernhardt said, leaning over him. Or I'll see you shut down. I mean that. I'm sincere about it.
The pitchman sighed and fished inside his shirt. He produced a key on a fine link chain. The crowd sighed. Sarah could stay no longer. Her stomach felt bloated and suddenly as still as death. Everything was going to come up, everything, and at express train speed. She stumbled away from Johnny's side and battered through the crowd.
Honey, you all right?
A woman's voice asked her, and Sarah shook her head blindly.
Sarah!
Sarah!
You just can't hide from Jekyll and Hyde, she thought incoherently. The fluorescent mask seemed to hang sickly before her eyes in the midway dark as she hurried past the merry-go-round. She struck a light pole with her shoulder, staggered, grabbed it, and threw up. It seemed to come all the way from her heels, convulsing her stomach like a sick, slick fist. She let herself go with it as much as she could. Smells like cotton candy, she thought, and with a groan she did it again, then again. Spots danced in front of her eyes. The last heave had brought up little more than mucus and air. Oh, my, she said weakly, and clung to the light pole to keep from falling over. Somewhere behind her, Johnny was calling her name, but she couldn't answer just yet, didn't want to. Her stomach was settling back down a little, and for just a moment, she wanted to stand here in the dark and congratulate herself on being alive, on having survived her night at the fair.
Sarah? Sarah?
She spat twice to clear her mouth a little.
Over here, Johnny.
He came around the carousel with its plaster horses frozen in mid-leap. She saw he was absently clutching a thick wad of greenbacks in one hand.
Are you all right?
No, but better. I threw up.
Oh, Jesus, let's go home.
He took her arm gently.
You got your money.
He glanced down at the wad of bills and then tucked it absently into his pants pocket.
Yeah, some of it or all of it, I don't know. That burly guy counted it out.
She took a handkerchief from her purse and began rubbing her mouth with it.
Drink of water, she thought. I'd sell my soul for a drink of water.
You ought to care, she said. It's a lot of money.
Found money brings bad luck, he said darkly. One of my mother's sayings. She had a million of them, and she's death on gambling.
Died in the wool Baptist, Sarah said, and then shuddered convulsively.
You okay? He asked, concerned.
The chills, she said. When we get in the car, I want the heat on full blast and... Oh, Lord, I'm gonna do it again.
She turned away from him and retched up spittle with a groaning sound. She staggered. He held her gently, but firmly.
Can you get back to the car?
Yes, I'm all right now.
But her head ached, and her mouth tasted foul, and the muscles of her back and belly all felt sprung out of joint, strained and achy. They walked slowly down the midway together, scuffing through the sawdust, passing tents that had been closed up and snugged down for the night. A shadow glided up behind them, and Johnny glanced around sharply, perhaps aware of how much money he had in his pocket. It was one of the teenagers, about 15 years old. He smiled shyly at them.
I hope you feel better, he said to Sarah.
It's those hot dogs, I bet. You can get a bad one pretty easy.
Ugh, don't talk about it, Sarah said.
You need a hand getting her to the car? He asked Johnny.
No thanks, we're fine.
Okay, I gotta cut out anyway.
But he paused a moment longer, his shy smile widening into a grin.
I love to see that guy take a beating.
He trotted off into the dark. Sarah's small white station wagon was the only car left in the dark parking lot. It crouched under a sodium light like a forlorn, forgotten pup. Johnny opened the passenger door for Sarah, and she folded herself carefully in. He slipped in behind the wheel and started it up.
It'll take a few minutes for the heater, he said.
Never mind. I'm hot now.
He looked at her and saw the sweat breaking on her face.
Maybe we ought to trundle you up to the emergency room at Eastern Maine Medical, he said. If it's salmonella, it could be serious.
No, I'm okay. I just want to go home and go to sleep. I'm going to get up just long enough tomorrow morning to call in sick at school and then go back to sleep again.
Don't even bother to get up that long. I'll call you in, Sarah.
She looked at him gratefully.
Would you?
Sure.
They were headed back to the main highway now. I'm sorry I can't come back to your place with you, Sarah said. Really and truly.
Not your fault.
Sure it is. I ate the bad hot dog. Unlucky Sarah. I love you, Sarah, Johnny said.
So it was out. It couldn't be called back. It hung between them and the moving car, waiting for someone to do something about it. She did what she could.
Thank you, Johnny.
They drove on in a comfortable silence. Chapter 2 1 It was nearly midnight when Johnny turned the wagon into her driveway. Sarah was dozing.
Hey, he said, cutting the motor and shaking her gently. We're here. Oh, okay.
She sat up and drew her coat more tightly about her. How do you feel?
Better. My stomach's sore and my back hurts, but better. Johnny, you take the car back to Cleve's with you.
No, I better not, he said. Someone would see it parked in front of the apartment house all night. That kind of talk we don't need.
But I was going to come back with you.
Johnny smiled. And that would have made it worth the risk, even if we had to walk 3 blocks. Besides, I want you to have the car in case you change your mind about the emergency room.
I won't.
You might. Can I come in and call a cab?
You sure can.
They went in and Sarah turned on the lights before being attacked by a fresh bout of the shivers.
The phone's in the living room. I'm going to lie down and cover up with a quilt.
The living room was small and functional, saved from a barracks flavor only by the splashy curtains, flowers in a psychedelic pattern and color, and a series of posters along one wall. Dylan at Forest Hills, Baez at Carnegie Hall, Jefferson Airplane at Berkeley, the Birds in Cleveland. Sarah lay down on the couch and pulled a quilt up to her chin. Johnny looked at her with real concern. Her face was paper white, except for the dark circles under her eyes. She looked about as sick as a person can get.
Maybe I ought to spend the night here, he said, just in case something happens, like a hairline fracture on the top of my spine.
She looked at him with rueful humor.
Well, you know, whatever.
The ominous rumbling in her nether regions decided her. She had fully intended to finish this night by sleeping with John Smith. It wasn't going to work out that way. But that didn't mean she had to end the evening with him in attendance while she threw up, dashed for the WC, and chugged most of a bottle of Pepto-Bismol.
I'll be okay, she said. It was just a bad carnival hot dog, Johnny. You could have just as easily gotten it yourself. Give me a call during your free period tomorrow.
You sure?
Yes, I am.
Okay, kid. He picked up the phone with no further argument and called his cab. She closed her eyes, lulled and comforted by the sound of his voice. One of the things she liked most about him was that he would always really try to do the right thing, the best thing, with no self-serving bullshit. That was good. She was too tired and feeling too low to play little social games. The deed's done, he said, hanging up. They'll have a guy over in 5 minutes.
At least you've got cab fare, she said, smiling.
And I planned the tip handsomely, he replied, doing it passable W.C. Fields.
He came over to the couch, sat beside her, held her hand.
Johnny, how did you do it?
Hmm?
The wheel. How could you do that?
It was a streak, that's all, he said, looking a little uncomfortable. Everybody has a streak once in a while, like at the racetrack or playing blackjack or just matching dimes.
No, she said.
Huh?
I don't think everybody does have a streak once in a while. It was almost uncanny. It scared me a little.
Did it?
Yes.
Johnny sighed.
Once in a while I get feelings, that's all. For as long as I can remember, since I was just a little kid. And I've always been good at finding things people have lost. Like that little Lisa Schumann at school. You know the girl I mean? Little sad mousy Lisa? She smiled. I know her. She's wandering in clouds of perplexity through my business grammar course.
She lost her class ring, Johnny said, and came to me in tears about it. I asked her if she'd checked the back corners of the top shelf in her locker. Just a guess, but it was there.
And you've always been able to do that?
He laughed and shook his head. Hardly ever. The smile slipped a little. But it was strong tonight, Sarah.
I had that wheel.
He closed his fist softly and looked at them, now frowning.
I had it right here. And it had the strangest goddamn associations for me.
Like what?
Rubber, he said slowly. Burning rubber. And cold. And ice. Black ice. Those things were in the back of my mind, God knows why. And a bad feeling. Like, to beware. She looked at him closely, saying nothing, and his face slowly cleared. But it's gone now, whatever it was. Nothing, probably. It was $500 worth of good luck anyway, she said.
Johnny laughed and nodded. He didn't talk anymore, and she drowsed, glad to have him there. She came back to wakefulness when headlights from outside splashed across the wall. His cab.
I'll call, he said, and kissed her face gently. You sure you don't want me to hang around?
Suddenly she did, but she shook her head.
Call me, she said.
Period 3, he promised. He went to the door.
Johnny?
He turned back.
I love you, Johnny, she said,
and his face lit up like a lamp. He blew a kiss.
Feel better, he said, and we'll talk.
She nodded, but it was 4.5 years before she talked to Johnny Smith again. 2. Do you mind if I sit up front? Johnny asked the cab driver. Nope, just don't bump your knee on the meter. It's delicate. Johnny slid his long legs under the meter with some effort and slammed the door. The cabbie, a middle-aged man with a bald head and a paunch, dropped his flag and the cab cruised up Flag Street. Where to? Cleves Mills, Johnny said. Main Street. I'll show you where. I gotta ask you for a fare and a half, the cabbie said. I don't like to, but I gotta come back empty from there. Johnny's hand closed absently over the lump of bills in his pants pocket. He tried to remember if he had ever had so much money on him at one time before. Once. He'd bought a 2-year-old Chevy for $1,200. On a whim, he'd asked for cash at the savings bank just to see what all that cash looked like. It hadn't been all that wonderful, but the surprise on the car dealer's face when Johnny pumped 12 $100 bills into his hand had been wonderful to behold. But this lump of money didn't make him feel good at all, just vaguely uncomfortable, and his mother's axiom recurred to him.
Found money brings.